From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. The world of finance used to be run like an elite patrician club. How did Wall Street enter the razzle-dazzle age of ruthless takeovers? On today's Fresh Air, Ron Chernow offers some answers. His new book looks at the rise of modern finance by tracing the history of the J.P. Morgan financing empire. Also, journalist Daniel Axt tells us about Barry Minko, the celebrated teen entrepreneur whose multi-million dollar carpet cleaning business was really built by conning investors. Rock historian Ed Ward profiles the Redbird and Blue Cat record labels, the founders with a songwriting team of Lieber and Stoller. And book critic John Leonard reviews the new novel by British writer Faye Weldon. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Foreign journalists, business people, and diplomats were ordered out of Lithuania as the Soviet Union tightened control on the secessionist Baltic Republic. Other moves by the Soviets today included the capture and beating of some Lithuanian deserters from the Soviet army and the seizure of another Communist Party building. A senior diplomat in Washington today used statements by Vice President Dan Quayle to justify his country's action in Lithuania. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
In a hastily called news conference at the Soviet embassy, Minister Counselor Sergei Chetverikov defended his government's seizure of army deserters from a Lithuanian psychiatric hospital.
Such a notion as discipline in the army. Even Vice President Quayle the other day admitted that there should be some discipline in any army.
A spokesman for the vice president said Quayle's remarks in no way countenanced the violent roundup of any deserters. The remarks come as the Bush administration has quieted its criticism of the Soviet actions in Lithuania. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater called the standoff a very complex and delicate diplomatic situation. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
The U.S. Southern Command in Panama still maintains that 314 Panamanian soldiers were killed in the December U.S. invasion. The Pentagon admits that those figures are estimates and that they differ sharply from other reports that claim only 50 Panamanian troops were killed. The military also estimates that 202 Panamanian civilians died, although human rights groups contend the number is much higher. Brazilian President Fernando Collor announced today he's suspending two provisional laws used in the past week to arrest prominent businessmen without bail. Those arrested were accused of violating strict new economic measures aimed at halting inflation, but the detentions quickly touched off a storm of protests. David Wellner reports from Rio.
President Collor admitted today he's been forced to backtrack by dropping the controversial laws, but he said he's doing so to honor his promise to defend Brazil's constitution. While eminent jurists have attacked the drastic laws as unconstitutional, many Brazilians were delighted to see the measures used to haul off supermarket owners to jail. Executives of a leading newspaper were also detained under the laws. The paper retaliated by publishing photos of President Collor and former Italian fascist dictator Benito Mussolini striking similar stances. The caption read, "Any resemblance is not mere coincidence." The media here have applauded the removal of the laws. For National Public Radio, I'm David Wellner in Rio de Janeiro.
Stock prices were mixed on Wall Street this morning, but they turned sharply higher by the close. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed up 29 and a quarter points at 2,736.9, with gains outpacing losses by a 3-2 margin. This is NPR. Cuba today jammed the first trial telecast from a United States TV transmitter aimed at its territory. The TV service, known as TV Marti, began its broadcast test this morning from a tethered balloon hovering over the Florida Keys. The test programming featured baseball highlights and entertainment features. Cuban officials maintain that the broadcasts are an illegal invasion of their airspace. Greyhound bus drivers say it's the company and not the union that's responsible for several dozen incidents of strike-related violence. The company announced today that it's offering $100,000 for information on the shootings. Susan Leffler has this report.
There have been more than two dozen shooting incidents in several states since the Amalgamated Council of Greyhound Local Unions walked off the job demanding higher wages. The company accuses the union of what it calls terrorist tactics and says it hopes the reward will encourage people to come forward with information. Union President Ed Strait accuses the company of provoking violence by hiring replacement workers.
All they have to do is make those buses stop going into the terminal and coming out of the terminal, and you could stop a lot of the violence that's happening right now because they're hitting our pickets. That's the violence.
Strait says the only death in the month-long strike occurred when a replacement driver ran over a union picketer in California. Negotiations between the union and Greyhound broke down last week. For National Public Radio, I'm Susan Leffler in Washington.
A New York grand jury today examined evidence in the Bronx Social Club fire that killed 87 people. That evidence includes a confession of arson from the man who's accused of the worst mass murder in U.S. history. The confession of 36-year-old Julio Gonzalez was shown on videotape. Police say Gonzalez set the fire in the entrance of the Happy Land Social Club after a fight with his former girlfriend, a worker at the club. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. During the first half of the century, the House of Morgan ruled over U.S. finance. It catered to the world's wealthiest families, the Astors, Vanderbilts, DuPonts. And it financed many of the giants of industry, U.S. Steel, General Electric, and General Motors. Morgan Stanley was known as the Rolls-Royce of investment bankers. My guest Ron Chernow has traced the history of this powerful banking empire in his new book, The House of Morgan, An American Banking Dynasty and the Rise of Modern Finance. The House of Morgan is made up of three banks, the commercial bank Morgan Guaranty Trust, Morgan Stanley, the investment bank, and the British merchant bank Morgan Grenfell. They were known for their genteel yet elitist way of doing business, but as Wall Street changed, Morgan began to participate in banking practices they had previously shunned. In 1974, Morgan Stanley financed the first hostile takeover of the modern era. It went on to be a top player in the game of takeovers and leveraged buyouts. Ron Chernow sees in the history of the House of Morgan the history of modern finance. I asked Chernow how the House of Morgan represented the old banking tradition.
Well, you know, the House of Morgan was really patterned after the House of Barings and the House of Rothschilds. One of the things that had initially fascinated me about the Morgan banks was that the Morgan banks would never post their name outside. Everything was strictly on a don't call us, we'll call you basis. These were people who didn't raid. They didn't really compete. You had to have exclusive relations or nothing with the House of Morgan. If the House of Morgan caught you even talking to another banker, they would cut you off. So this was a rather clubby, genteel, civilized, but rather closed world of banking.
Civilized, on the other hand, they're the people who we knew as the robber barons. They gained control over the railroads in America, the steel empires. What was their role in industry here?
Well, you have to understand that the House of Morgan became powerful initially because American railroads and American industry in the 19th century were financed by England. In fact, one of the oddities of the House of Morgan is that it started in London. It started with an American banker named George Peabody, who was a bachelor. He had to shop around for an heir, and he chose Mr. Junior Spencer Morgan from Boston. It was Junior Spencer Morgan's son, Pierpont, who became the famous robber baron with the bulbous nose and the flashing eyes. Now, because the British investors were financing American railroads and industry, they really wanted a czar on Wall Street. They wanted someone who would represent their interests and crackheads if necessary. And the American securities in London had a very bad reputation. States like Maryland and Pennsylvania and Mississippi were always defaulting. There were chaotic railroad wars and constant bankruptcies. And so they felt that they needed their representative and a strong representative of their interests in New York. And that turned out to be Mr. J. Pierpont Morgan.
Now, what did that mean, though?
In what sense?
That he was their representative. What kind of control did Morgan have?
Okay, what happened was that Morgan would sit on the boards of various railroads, and his vote would count much more heavily than any other vote. In fact, the way that he became so powerful was that in the 1890s, at a time when the railroads were far and away the most powerful industry in the United States, a lot of them went bankrupt, and the Morgan Bank became a gigantic bankruptcy mill. And when they emerged from this bankruptcy mill, Morgan would create a voting trust. It was usually Morgan and two or three or four of his cronies, and they would rule the railroads after that, so that it actually, because of the weakness and chaos in American industry at the time, the House of Morgan ended up directly ruling these companies and financing them. And, of course, it got into a lot of trouble because there were fears that its power was excessive, and there was a very important campaign that was undertaken by Louis Brandeis to try to create some separation between the bankers and the companies. This is very important because we're coming full circle in Wall Street history where the bankers are again encroaching on the company. And my great fear, and one of the reasons that I wrote the book, is that people really don't understand this whole history, this 50-year campaign by people like Louis Brandeis and William O. Douglas and other people in order to create some healthy professional distance between the bankers and the industrialists.
Ron Chernow is my guest. He's the author of the new book, The House of Morgan, An American Banking Dynasty and the Rise of Modern Finance. You call the current period that we're in the casino age. Why use the metaphor of the casino?
Okay, Wall Street basically does two things. You know, there's a necessary side to Wall Street that we shouldn't forget. Companies and governments have to raise capital for productive investment, so it's not all greed. On the other hand, there is a speculative side to Wall Street as well, and I think that what we have seen during the last few years is a grotesque expansion of the speculative side of Wall Street to the point where it's almost dwarfed the very raison d'etre of Wall Street, which is to raise money for plant and equipment in order to finance the business of the country. And so that I felt that this speculative overlay was really smothering the more important function of Wall Street, which was to raise money for business. If I can, Terry, let me go back to what I was saying before about the bankers dominating the companies. In the old days, a company like J.P. Morgan and Company would have its representative on the board of a company, and this was really like running up a flag and warning the rest of the banking industry that this was a captive company and that you didn't want to mess with them. Now, this was an unhealthy and anti-competitive situation. And through various government regulations, the government tried to create some distance to create a more competitive situation. The government succeeded also because of changes in the marketplace that we can talk about. The House of Morgan began to lose this exclusive lock that it had on companies. Let me give an example. Morgan Stanley in the 1950s and 60s was the banker to seven of the 10 largest companies in the world. It was the exclusive banker to six of the seven sister oil companies. It was the exclusive banker to General Motors, AT&T, IBM, General Electric. It had extraordinary power, and nobody could touch them. As a result, they could afford to be a rather genteel and patrician firm. The balance of power in Wall Street began to change quite radically in the 1960s. It wasn't reported at the time, but I find that in speaking to the former partners of Morgan Stanley, you realize that there was something close to panic going on there in the 1960s for the following reason. The power balance was tilting from the corporations and the bankers controlling things to the institutional investors controlling things. And by the institutional investors, I mean the pension funds, the mutual funds, the insurance companies. These large portfolios, they had very specialized need for trading houses like Salomon Brothers and Goldman Sachs that could help them to manage these gigantic stock and bond portfolios. The House of Morgan had always had this very patrician disdain for trading and distribution. People don't realize it was a kind of tiny wholesale operation. They would allocate securities to other houses. They would not sell, they would not distribute, and they would not trade. Because trading and distribution became so important, other companies were able to steal away business for the first time from the House of Morgan. And we really entered into a competitive free-for-all because of these changes in the marketplace and also because of various changes in government regulation. So that what we now have in the 1980s is a mixed blessing. It's a genuinely competitive situation of every banker scrambling after every company. And we're seeing that the results can be quite damaging. You know, for reformers like Louis Brandeis and William O. Douglas wanted to see the golden chains of captivity finally smashed, by which the Morgan Bank had controlled companies. But what has happened is that as these patrician firms no longer have that sort of assured business that they did in the days of relationship banking, they have tried to compensate for it by undertaking hostile raids, leverage buyouts, and other things that have had a very damaging effect on the whole economy. So that there have been all sorts of unforeseen consequences of change and reform that we're living through now.
Well, you write a lot about how Wall Street became more ruthless as it became more democratic. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk about that some more. My guest is Ron Chernow, author of the new book, The House of Morgan, an American Banking Dynasty and the Rise of Modern Finance. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Ron Chernow is my guest. We're talking about his new book, The House of Morgan. Now let's talk a little bit more about the reasons why Morgan and other banks and investment companies started changing the way they did business. You say that bankers changed from being like Scrooge, scrutinizing every mm-hmm. loan, to becoming salesmen in an era of abundant capital. Can mm-hmm. you explain that?
Well, you know, one of the things that I tried to do in the book, I really started out by desire to try to understand the Wall Street of the 1980s. And I worked backwards, and I found that if I had a very long-term historical perspective, I thought that I might see different things that people who were just focusing on the last 5 or 10 years wouldn't see. And one thing that I discovered is that if you go back to the 19th century, a banker was a Scrooge. I mean, a banker was infamous for being a rather dour and austere person who enjoyed saying no. The reason was that capital markets were primitive. Capital was still scarce. We didn't have major national and international companies the way that we had now. And so that the banker was allocating very scarce capital. What we've seen in the post-war era is a transformation of the banker from Scrooge to a kind of glad-handing salesman. Back in the 1960s, Chase Manhattan Bank introduced an ad campaign, "You have a friend at Chase Manhattan." No banker ever wanted to be anyone's friend. Quite the contrary. The banker was someone who looked at you with a rather jaundiced and skeptical eye and who enjoyed saying no. And so we have moved into a situation of an abundance of capital, of national and international financial markets being increasingly synchronized and interlaced. And so that we're dealing, I think, now with certain problems that go with a superabundance of capital, you know, where you have situations where hostile raiders, at least until recently, were able to raise billions of dollars through junk bonds in order to take over major American corporations. And where the corporations themselves have accumulated so much capital that they can act as their own banker. In fact, one quote that I have in the book from one of the partners at Morgan Stanley predicted in 1970 that their major competition in future would come from their clients.
What does it mean that a large corporation no longer needed a banker, they could create their own capital?
Well, you see, if you go back before the creation of the Securities Exchange Commission in the 1930s, if a company wanted to float its stocks or bonds on a public exchange, the consumers, the people who were buying those stocks or bonds, might not be familiar with the company. I mean, Pierpont Morgan created U.S. Steel in 1901. A lot of the famous names of American industry were just being created at the turn of the century. So the banker became very important because it was the banker's imprimatur, the banker's cachet on an issue that assured investors that it was safe. Whereas nowadays, if someone offers you bonds from AT&T or General Motors or General Electric, you don't need the House of Morgan to assure you that it's a safe issue. In fact, the capital strength, the financial power of those corporations is much greater than that of the Morgan Bank or any other bank. And so that the banker at one point held the keys to the kingdom. The other thing that has happened, of course, is that with the Securities and Exchange Commission, you can now get a prospectus that will give you an enormous amount of information about a company so that you no longer have to rely on the word of your banker before buying the shares in a company.
So Morgan and other banks ended up getting into mergers and hostile takeovers because they couldn't make money the traditional way.
They couldn't make money the traditional way. They also, the Morgan Bank, this may sound technical, but it's not. The Morgan Bank always actually had very little capital by modern standards. They didn't really need the capital. They would put their name on an issue and the name would suffice. As the trading and distribution became more important, that did require a lot of capital because they would actually buy a whole issue and then turn around and sell it to the public. So what the Morgan Bank found itself with, both Morgan Stanley and even more recently Morgan Guaranty, but Morgan Stanley back in the 1970s when they launched the first hostile raids, they were in a situation where they had little capital but an extraordinary client list. So what they realized was that by turning to a fee business, by providing advice, they didn't need to risk their very limited capital, and they could also take advantage of this extraordinary client list.
So you have this patrician elite group of men, the House of Morgan, suddenly getting into hostile takeovers and you know, leverage buyouts and stuff. How does that change the makeup inside the House? You know, the relationships between people, who gets in, who has power?
It has very dramatically changed the sociology of Morgan Stanley and the sociology of Wall Street.
Mm-hmm.
There's a good side to this. I mean, you know, mine is kind of a tragic story because a lot of these changes that we have seen on Wall Street have democratized Wall Street. When they went into trading and distribution, you suddenly didn't need a social register background or an Ivy League education, although those things might help. So that people who had formerly been excluded on Wall Street were suddenly hired. Also, in terms of the merger and acquisition work, a much more kind of macho, aggressive person was suddenly brought into these firms. Also, Morgan Stanley, up through 1970 or so, had only one Jewish partner. I talk a lot in the book about the vein of anti-Semitism in the House. But what happened at Morgan Stanley when they carried out this first hostile raid in 1974, it was still a partnership. They were afraid of their legal liability. So they searched around for a lawyer who was expert in this area because their old white shoe law firm, Davis Polk & Wardwell, didn't do hostile takeovers and looked down upon it. Well, they found a man named Joe Flom. Joe Flom, back in the 1950s, had started advising people on takeovers, and it was really kind of, you know, the scraps. It was the dregs. It wasn't a big business at that point. Joe Flom was in a firm of four partners. Today, Joe Flom is the number one takeover lawyer on Wall Street, and his firm, Skadden, Arps, Meagher & Flom, I think is either the largest or one of the largest in the country with almost 1,000 lawyers. So on the one hand, I find, particularly being Jewish myself, that I saw that a lot of the different trends that I was deploring also had a healthy democratizing influence on Wall Street in terms of letting the outsiders in. But as I say, I'm not at all pleased with the sorts of activities that they were in general performing.
Well, let's look at this premise here. If Wall Street becomes more ruthless as it becomes more democratic, is it becoming more ruthless because of who's coming in now that it's not just this closed WASP club of men? Or
no,
is it because it's becoming more ruthless and that's the kind of behavior that's
encouraged? No, I'm glad you asked that question because there has been a repeated speculation over the last few years, and it formed the subject of a new novel by Michael Thomas called Hanover Place, that there's going to be some kind of anti-Semitic backlash because of the involvement of a lot of Jewish lawyers and investment bankers in the takeovers. I think that, you know, a couple of points that I would like to make. The hostile takeovers were initiated by Morgan Stanley. It's the waspiest firm on Wall Street. There are many raiders, Bill Farrell, T. Boone Pickens, and others who are not Jewish. And so to begin with, that is something of a caricature. More importantly, and I think that your question addresses it, The ruthlessness is not because of the various ethnic groups who have been recruited onto Wall Street. It's the nature of the activities itself, that takeover work, leverage buyouts, these things require ruthless personalities. If you go back to the more genteel era of the 1950s, where the major business of Wall Street was just issuing straight industrial bonds, it was important if you had a smooth golf swing, if you had good cocktail party chatter. In other words, if you had good relations with clients, that was the most important thing. And obviously you had, and I interviewed many of them, a group of extremely charming, pleasant, and very rich men who did it. So it's the functions that have changed. But as the functions changed, it permitted new ethnic groups who had always been the outsiders on Wall Street to enter Wall Street. That is, as it were, the silver lining of the changes during the past 20 years.
Earlier in our conversation, you were talking about how legislation and regulations were enacted many years ago to try to end conflict of interest between banks and companies. And you implied that there's a new kind of conflict of interest that's set in the modern era. What is the nature of this new conflict of interest?
It really has to do with the leverage buyouts, or to use the vogue word on Wall Street, merchant banking. And what merchant banking means is that investment banks, instead of simply advising raiders or companies on takeovers, actually are carrying out in whole or in part the takeover themselves. And, you know, a lot of bankers are crowing about the fact, merchant banking, we're going back to our roots, we're becoming like the old House of Morgan. And what I wanted to say in the book is that that's not necessarily a history that you want to repeat, for the following reason. Morgan Stanley, for is one of the largest factors now in the paper and wood products industry. They engaged in leverage buyouts for a number of large paper and wood products companies. Now, for one thing, how can they pretend to advise other companies in that industry when they themselves are now the competition? You can't be, to use the jargon, both a principal and an agent at the same time. Two, if the banks take over a company, there's always the temptation that they're going to load up that company with more debt than is really good for the company, because it generates business for the banks. And if some of the people on Wall Street today would go back and read Other People's Money by Louis Brandeis, he described exactly that happening with the House of Morgan and the New Haven Railroad, which finally defaulted in 1913, in part because the House of Morgan had loaded up this captive company with more debt than they could really service. And so history is repeating itself. But I wish that some of the people who were applauding this would go back and read some of the history.
You know, we're already starting to think of the 80s as the era of ruthlessness and greed on Wall Street. Because it's seen as a phenomenon of the 80s, it would imply, oh, but that's in our past. Do you think it is in the past? Are things stabling off at all on Wall Street, or are things as ruthless as they were, you know, in the 80s?
No, I think that things have already stabilized. I think that we'll see more contraction on Wall Street. I think that the big event was the collapse of the junk bond market, because it was the, you know, every time that you have a speculative binge, there's an enormous amount of rationalization that goes with it, and people claim that the old rules don't really apply. And I think that with what's happening with the Campo bankruptcy and the collapse of the RJR and Nabisco bonds, people are beginning to see that in spite of a lot of eyewash talked during the 1980s, that the old-time religion in the last analysis is still the valid one. So I think that at this point, enough people have already gotten burned by some of the speculative excesses of the 1980s that I think a new wariness has set in. And I might say, Terry, if you just look at the books that are coming out about Wall Street, what a radical change there has been just in 12 months in terms of the perception of Wall Street. The glorification has completely disappeared. And in books like Larry's Poker, Barbarians of the Gate, what you see is a picture of total disenchantment with Wall Street. And this has really come about over the course of just a year or two.
Ron Chernow, I want to thank you very much for speaking with us about finance. Thank you.
Thank you, Terry.
Ron Chernow's new book is called The House of Morgan, an American Banking Dynasty and the Rise of Modern Finance. I'm Terry Grossen. This is Fresh Air. Next time, my guest will be one of the pioneers of family therapy, Dr. Salvador Mnuchin. He became known for his confrontative yet effective therapy sessions. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When journalist Daniel Axt first came upon entrepreneur Barry Minko in 1985, Axt wrote about a clean-cut, ambitious teenager who had built a carpet cleaning company into a million-dollar business. By 1987, Axt had uncovered evidence that would implicate the boy Wonder in a major fraud scheme. Coming up, we talk with Axt about his new book, Wonder Boy, Barry Minko, the kid who swindled Wall Street. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles the 1960s recording labels Redbird and Blue Cat. Their hits included Chapel of Love and The Boy from New York City. And book critic John Leonard reviews the latest novel by Faye Weldon. She's best known for her novel, The Life and Loves of a She-Devil. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The Soviet Union today defended its seizure of army deserters from two hospitals in Lithuania and called for understanding in the United States. A Soviet diplomat in Washington said that deserters are dealt with harshly in other countries, and that so far force has not been used against citizens of the breakaway Baltic Republic. In Washington, the Bush administration has refused to condemn Soviet action in Lithuania. NPR's Brian Naylor reports from the White House.
The White House is keeping mum about reports that Soviet soldiers forcibly removed army deserters from Lithuanian hospitals where they had sought refuge. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater again warned against the use of force or intimidation, but would not comment on what he called individual aspects of the situation there. The spokesman said the administration was concerned about how his remarks were interpreted yesterday, when he said further action on the part of Moscow could have adverse international repercussions and could be counterproductive to U.S.-Soviet relations. Today, Fitzwater said the administration does not feel inflammatory language is helpful. "We believe this situation in Lithuania represents a delicate balance," he said, "and we don't want to take any action to make that situation worse." This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
A leading Soviet official says that Soviet production has fallen for 3 months in a row, and reforms are needed before the end of the year to rescue the Soviet economy. A deputy prime minister is quoted by TASS as saying social programs will be installed to cushion the harsh effects of such reforms. A week ago, more than 400 ethnic Albanian children were rushed to a hospital complaining of lung and skin problems. Ethnic Albanians charged that Slavs caused the illness by poisoning the students. An international team of doctors was sent to Yugoslavia to investigate the illness and today delivered its findings. Pierre Vickery has more on the story.
An international panel of doctors sent to Kosovo to investigate the mystery illness has blamed the ailment not on poison but on mass hysteria. The findings of the international panel seem to confirm the initial suspicion that the illness was part of a political campaign to protest Serbian oppression in the overwhelmingly ethnic Albanian province. Exactly a year ago, Kosovo, which had enjoyed local autonomy, was forcibly returned to Serbian control from Belgrade. Over 100 Albanians have died in street protests, and the region is now under direct army and riot police control. For National Public Radio, this is Pierre Vickery in Zagreb.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up over 29 points to close at 2,736.94 in moderate trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. In the mid-60s, the Redbird and Blue Cat record labels were a playground for songwriters from New York's Brill Building, people like Ellie Greenwich and Jeff Barry. The labels, which were financed by the songwriters and producers Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller, kept rolling out hits. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward has a survey of some of them.
By 1964, Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller were sort of like the grand old men of the New York record business. They'd been writing hits together since the early 50s, just out of high school. And most recently, they'd helped a young kid named Phil Spector get on his feet. Looking around for something to do next, they decided to start a record label, and for some reason, they called it Redbird. Its trademark was a picture of a red bird strumming a guitar. For their first release, they took the Dixie Cups, three girls from New Orleans a band leader had recommended to them, gave them a song written by Phil Spector, Jeff Barry, and Ellie Greenwich, and watched it shoot straight to number one.
Go into the chapel and we're gonna get married. Go into the chapel and we're gonna get married. We are really love you and we're gonna get married. Go into the chapel of love.
Well, that was easy. So easy, in fact, that Lieber and Stoller began losing interest in Redbird almost immediately. Still, they realized that somebody had to oversee the label's day-to-day operations, and they found another veteran, George Goldner, who'd put out some of the finest New York doo-wops in the mid-50s. Goldner knew the same songwriters Lieber and Stoller did, including a newcomer named George Morton, known to everybody as Shadow because he was so unassuming. He couldn't sing at all, but on a demo like Dressed in Black, which we just heard, it was obvious he had great pop sense. So Goldner found him a group of girls to work with. Wow, another top 10 hit. That was Redbird's 8th record. Need another one? Jeff Barry was ready with five girls from Jersey City who called themselves the Jelly Beans. Like everything Redbird did was hitting the charts. Could George Goldner sell anything? Some friends of Phil Spector's got together and decided to find out. This didn't do quite as well, but it came out in February, for heaven's sakes.
My folks moved to New York from California. I should have listened when my buddy said I want ya.
Redbird was doing so well that early in 1965, they introduced another label, Blue Cat, which would concentrate on more serious soul music. Guess what? Blue Cat's second release was a hit, too. Ad-libs had been recording for various people for 3 years, and The Boy from New York City was their first and only hit. But the label's output wasn't just novelty and pop fluff. Blue Cat had some success with blues singer Alvin Robinson, who made a record that had a profound influence on Jimi Hendrix.
People see me, but they just don't know what's in my heart and why I love you so. I love you, baby, like a minor love gold. So come on, baby, let the good time roll.
They even put a New Orleans Mardi Gras Indian chant onto the charts. In the 2 years before Lieber and Stoller sold Redbird and Blue Cat to George Goldner, the label scored 2 number one hits, 6 top 10 ones, and 24 others that made it on the pop charts. I've only been able to scratch the surface of these labels' output here, the highlights of an amazing success story.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll, and he writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air. In the mid-1980s, Barry Minko was one of the great business success stories. He founded a carpet cleaning company when he was 15, against his parents' wishes. And by the time he was 21, Z-Best Carpet Cleaning was a $200 million enterprise. He presided over more than 100 employees, including his parents, who, like everyone else on staff, had to call him Mr. Minko. The teenage entrepreneur was profiled in newspapers, magazines, and on TV shows. Los Angeles twice celebrated Barry Minko Day. But by the time he was 22 in 1988, Minko was behind bars, guilty of 57 counts of fraud in an elaborate swindle that bilked investors of their money. Daniel Axt is the author of a new book about Minko called Wonder Boy. Axt played a part in Minko's downfall by exposing a credit card scam in a 1987 LA Times article. But 2 years before, Axt helped make Minko famous by profiling him in the L.A. Times.
Well, it's one of those trite newspaper stories, I guess. It was a slow news day. I was working for the Los Angeles Times. It was hot. I drove out to hear him address a group of collegian entrepreneurs in the San Fernando Valley. I was, I guess, somewhat charmed and amazed. He made all of these college students look pretty somnolent by comparison. And I chatted with him and made some attempt to check him out with the Better Business Bureau and so forth, and didn't turn up anything, so I wrote a story about him, a modestly skeptical story, but in retrospect, a kind of foolish one. And that story really stood him in good stead during his ascension.
Well, even though you were skeptical, what effect did this article have?
Well, the article was in the Los Angeles Times, a fairly respectable publication, and it was used by Barry and his publicist to get a lot more publicity on television, on radio, on other magazines, and so on and so forth. And there was a snowball effect, and ultimately he went very far as a result.
So Barry Minko's image was the young, incredibly successful entrepreneur. Let's talk about what the real story was. How much of his carpet cleaning business had to do with cleaning carpets?
Well, he did clean a few carpets here and there. It was your bad luck if you called him for that, but he did clean a few carpets, he and his minions. But really what he claimed to be doing, and the way he sold stock to the public, was he claimed to be restoring buildings damaged by water and fire. Multi-million dollar jobs, huge contracts, $5-7 million, Dallas, Sacramento, and so forth. And unfortunately, these contracts and these buildings turned out never to have existed. The whole business was made of whole cloth. And in fact, one of my favorite things about Barry was that At one point, someone actually offered him a $5 million restoration contract, and he had the good sense to refuse flat out because he knew that to pollute the lie in any way with some real work would lead to no good. And in fact, he and his men couldn't have changed a light bulb if they wanted to.
Living in Los Angeles, which you were during the time this story was happening, you got to see Barry Minkow's TV commercials, which those of us out of the area didn't get to see. Can you describe a couple of them?
They were wonderful. You have to understand, first of all, that Southern California is covered with carpet. And so theoretically, everybody needs carpet cleaning services. But the trouble is many of them are crooked and unreliable. Barry's TV commercials showed first some really horrible, cretinous carpet cleaners showing up, with fat cigars and so forth, to disoriented-looking folks coming to clean your carpet. And then finally, after two or three images of this, Barry turns up, and he's in a suit and tie, and he's got an 800 number, and everything is orderly and straightforward, and, they take credit cards, too, by the way. And so the contrast was, he played beautifully on the reality of the carpet cleaning business.
Now, how did he use these phony contracts to get people to invest in his company?
Barry had a rather classic Ponzi scheme. A Ponzi scheme is when someone borrows from Peter to pay Paul. And the way you get money from Peter to pay Paul is to promise Peter an enormous return on his investment. So you can get $100,000 from Peter if you promise that in 6 weeks you'll give him back $150,000. And Barry's skill at this was that he would always pay the big return, but often he would bring a check and he would say, now you can take the money now or you can reinvest it and get an even greater return for another 6 weeks. And in fact, the check was often rubber because he knew people. He understood human nature, really in an uncanny way. And so people would reinvest, and he never really had to pay out the money.
So while you're robbing Peter to pay Paul, you're skimming a little money off the top, of course.
Well, of course, there's tremendous leakage, and you use it to leverage yourself onto a much higher plane. I mean, Barry was about to take over a large national carpet cleaning business that had the contract to do carpet cleaning for Sears, and it was a legitimate business, and Drexel Burnham was raising money for him, and had he succeeded, I suppose it's entirely possible that he might have gone legit.
That would have been some irony.
And Barry went around telling people he had these huge contracts and he needed capital to do the jobs. He said that he was such an expert at negotiating carpet prices and so forth that he needed to pay, he could pay cash on the barrelhead and get a good rate. Every business needs capital, and ultimately Barry even sold stock to the public on this basis. And in fact, at its peak, the company was worth over $200 million on the stock exchange.
Why did Barry Minkow keep needing new investors?
Well, his problem was that he wasn't doing anything to generate any money. And the only way he could pay off the old investors was with new investors. There was really no business there. There was nothing there. I mean, he took advantage of a central characteristic in everyday life, which is the assumption of verisimilitude. I mean, you haven't asked me for identification. You assume I'm Dan Axt. We arranged for me to be here and so forth. I mean, I might be anybody. Perhaps the book that you read was a single copy that wasn't even published. I mean, we assume a certain veracity in life, and especially in capitalism. I mean, that's the essence of the whole thing. And Barry had the brains to realize that this was the case and to exploit it so that investors would say, well, I'm not just going to invest with this kid. I want to see the hard facts. I want to see the numbers. And what they never imagined was that Barry would simply make them up. He and his assistants would forge the reports and the vouchers and so forth, and all the numbers would be entirely concocted.
Now, on top of all this, there was also credit card fraud.
Yes, and this was his undoing, and it was really a foolish mistake because when I stumbled across the credit card fraud, I thought it was fairly significant. We thought at the LA Times it was significant, but little did we know that it was really just a little blip, a little pimple on this huge fraud that he was carrying out.
What was the credit card fraud?
Well, basically, if you called him to clean a carpet and one of his people came and cleaned your carpet and you paid with a credit card, and you were charged for $50, you had $50 worth of service, chances are you might be charged for $500 worth or $1,000 worth. And he did this all over the place, and he even had a separate little flower shop that was processing these receipts. And so he would work on the float. He would get this money and use it to keep himself running. And unfortunately, it was something that was, unfortunately for Barry, I should say, we discovered it and published it in the Los Angeles Times, and the effect of that negative story was out of all proportion, really, to what we thought it would be. I mean, it was just the company stock went into a tailspin, and it turned out to be sort of like pulling a single loose thread in a garment that causes the whole thing to unravel.
How come people don't notice this kind of credit card scam right away? I mean, if you get a bill of $3,000 for something that you didn't even use, aren't you going to notice it?
Well, many people do notice it. Well, first of all, many people don't notice it. The average person doesn't look at his or her credit card bill, apparently, and just pays it or pays some installment or something. Other people, when they do notice it, they get it straightened out, but it takes months. And meanwhile, Barry and his people had the use of the money. Because the beauty of credit cards for a business is that they're paid, the business gets its money immediately from a bank. So it was the float that he depended on. Again, it was just he had his focus on one thing, which was cash now.
Reading your book, I started to see parallels between the TV evangelists and their frauds in the 80s and Barry Minkow's entrepreneurial fraud in the 80s.
Yes, it's interesting you mention that because Barry, since he went away to prison, as I understand it, has found the Lord and is now conducting Bible classes behind bars. He took a correspondence course from Jerry Falwell or somebody and started conducting these classes. But in fact, there was a kind of a theological dimension, I think, to what Barry did and to the ethos that was afoot in the land. Business was really exalted at that time, and the Japanese seemed to be buying everything, and there was all this economic uncertainty, and anyone who could succeed in business, certainly the way Barry did, was exalted. And for Barry to do it before he was old enough to buy a drink, just seemed sublime, I think, to many people.
Do you think the Minkow story sums up anything about the 1980s?
Well, the great thing about Barry, to me, is the sense in which he so well personifies the whole era. I mean, so much of what had been productive work seemed to shift over into paper shuffling and buying and selling of assets and moving money around the world and manipulations of every kind, rather than actually producing something that somebody could use. And, what better example than Barry Minkow, who didn't produce anything except for a while satisfaction for investors, and then he produced disaster. I mean, he, the image of the Ponzi scheme itself, a scheme that relies on the concept of infinity for success, which, of course, there's no such thing as all the money in the world, it seems to me a perfect symbol for the period.
Daniel Axe, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
Daniel Axe is the author of the new book, Wonder Boy, Barry Minkow, The Kid Who Swindled Wall Street. It's published by Scribner's. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Well, the defense rested in the Poindexter trial. What do you have on that?
Our own Nina Totenberg, who has been at the trial every day, will be with us again this afternoon to explain what happened. This is especially interesting because Nina has been saying all along that since Poindexter's defense was what is called a state-of-mind defense, that it probably would be necessary for him to testify, and he did not. The other lead story that we're watching, of course, is Lithuania, where, every day brings additional pressure from the Soviet Union on that country. And we have an interview today with LBJ's biographer, Robert Caro.
Thanks, Linda. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. British author Faye Weldon has written short stories and a biography of Rebecca West, but she's best known for her humorous feminist novel, The Life and Loves of a She-Devil, which was made into a British TV miniseries and a feature movie starring Meryl Streep and Roseanne Barr. Weldon has a new novel, The Cloning of Joanna May. Book critic John Leonard has this review.
From a Faye Weldon novel, we expect some sexual politics, some Jane Austen, some Doris Lessing, some Colette, but also some Evelyn Waugh. Weldon puts a clever spin on everything. You can read The Cloning of Joanna May as a witty feminist novel about nature versus nurture, big business and big science, gardens and communes. But it's a lot trickier, really, a game played with fate. This is the situation. Carl May spent most of his lower-class childhood in a kennel where his mother chained him like a dog. He grew up angry and hungry to own real estate and biological laboratories and nuclear power stations. His wife, Joanna, spent most of her upper-class childhood in a lovely house where nobody was ever home for her. She married a man who noticed, who was very much always there. Somewhere along the line, because she was curious, Joanna took a lover, an Egyptologist. When Carl found them among the mummies, he divorced Joanna and murdered the Egyptologist. But before the divorce, clever Carl also had Joanna cloned 4 times by parthenogenesis. Joanna, at age 60, has 4 30-year-old sisters, daughters, twins she's never even met. They all get together to keep Carl from owning and killing them. Meanwhile, Carl is busy lying to the British public about Chernobyl. Carl isn't altogether evil. His hunger drove him mad. And Joanna's not entirely blameless. She conspired at her own servitude. Once they loved each other, and maybe they still do, but life has gotten out of hand, like Chernobyl. If sex is political, the politics are anarchy. With a grin, Weldon wonders if anarchy isn't an antidote to fate. Not for nothing, in one corner of Carl May's empire, is there a department of divinations, tears of blood in the I Ching, teacups with coffins, the ace of spades. Not for nothing is there so much Egypt. To be sure, Joanna believes she's trapped in a web of shame, outrage, fear, and desire, the 4 saving and refining passions of the universe, so equally proportioned that they cancel each other out. The shame which should purify, she says, the outrage which should move to action, the fear which should quieten, the desire which should sanctify, brought to nothing. But her clones, likewise a foursome, besides being aspects of her own character, are also tarot cards, a queen of wands for the power of the intellect, a queen of pentacles for the strength of the material world, a queen of swords for the capacity to endure, a queen of cups for sensual perception. Shuffle this deck and you get a new deal. I won't tell you what the new deal is, but listen to Joanna think about her clones. These women were less the sum of their genes than Joanna was, by virtue of being born into a later decade, as if time itself was a factor in the making of a personality and ought to be included, along with diet and education and social expectation, as a complementary building block, each year its special character, as with wine, and due to something more than weather, rather some complex, so far undefined pattern at work. Interesting, except that it smacked of that insult to the civilized and rational mind, astrology. Astrology. That's not feminist. That's just wicked.
John Leonard reviewed The Cloning of Joanna May by Faye Weldon. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Naomi Person, with assistance from Joan Tuohy, Allison Dufty, and Roberta Shorrock, who also directed today's show. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-225-8200. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet Salvador Mnuchin, a pioneer in the field of family therapy. Also, poet and playwright Amiri Baraka, formerly known as Leroy Jones, wrote his autobiography several years ago. We talk with Hetty Jones, whose new memoir tells a different story of their brief marriage. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.